Let's return now to this week's series on cybersecurity. More industrial and commercial operations are going online. That's good for efficiency. It also means enterprises are more vulnerable to cyber thieves and cyber spies. Security experts say the biggest concern is computer snooping from China. While this is a problem for some, turns out it's a business opportunity for others. NPR's Tom Gelton says it's boom time for firms specializing in busting Chinese hackers.
The hot new cybersecurity firms barely pay attention to cyber criminals. They're just after someone's money. It's fairly easy to fend them off. The more serious cyber intruders are the ones who want one particular thing, a new airplane design, for example. Threat researcher Dmitry Alperovich says they'll target whoever has it, and they'll be persistent.
Because if they're after your specific information, if they're after the Dreamliner specs, there's only one place to get it, and that's Boeing.
This is what's called a targeted threat. Cyber intruders going after particular trade secrets or inside information. These intruders are very determined. They won't give up until they get exactly what they want, and they're a growing problem.
If you think in terms of someone who's going to get into your network and stay there for a while, it's becoming more popular.
Richard Baitlick is chief security officer for a company called Mandiant. He says more often than not, these targeted threats originate in China.
The Russians have done that for a while, but not in the same way that the Chinese have. They tended to be quiet. They tended to be more creative. The Chinese are very loud and broad and aggressive.
And there's been such an explosion in these targeted intrusions from China that there are now cybersecurity firms that specialize in dealing with them. Mandiant may be the leading example. It doesn't try to protect its customers from viruses or other malicious software. They're more like an intelligence firm. They want to identify the intruder and his methods. Richard Baitlick says, after a while, you can actually figure out an enemy's distinctive techniques.
And you see them fumbling around, and they can't get whatever it is they need to do to work. And then there's a pause, and then someone else, you can tell someone else is there, because they type at a different frequency, they're entering different commands, no spelling mistakes, whatever. They'll get that part of the playbook to work, and then it goes back to whoever the first guy was. So there's definite signs of junior people, more experienced people.
Mandiant has identified about 20 Chinese groups responsible for targeted threats, in cybersecurity lingo, advanced persistent threats, or APTs. Kevin Mandia, the company founder, says if Mandiant can tell a company what APT group is after it, the company can defend itself better.
We can turn to a team that's going off to some Fortune 500 company and say, hey, all the evidence points to it's APT group 1 or APT group 5, and immediately know the tools they use, the IP addresses they use, the passphrases they use when they encrypt data, where they store their files on the machine.
Focusing in-depth on the cyber adversary, its goals, its tactics, is the Mandiant approach to cybersecurity, and business is booming.
They were early, and now it's the next big thing in security.
Richard Steenen is a cyber industry analyst.
So there's dozens, if not hundreds, of service providers doing things similar to Mandiant, and product companies coming out of the woodwork.
A new entrant in this field is CrowdStrike, a company co-founded by threat researcher Dmitry Alperovich. He says his company, like Mandiant and others in this growing field, will specialize in these advanced persistent threats, persistent being the key word. Their customers will be under constant pressure.
There's really no organization, including government agencies, that can prevent this type of attack. So you need to shift your mode into thinking that you're always under a persistent state of compromise, and you need to start thinking about how you want to hunt on the network.
That's the new cybersecurity game, hunting the adversary, tracking him down wherever he goes on a network and confronting him. One reason businesses like this are growing, the Mandiant guys say it's a lot more fun to fight the adversary head-on than to try to come up with some software to protect someone from him. And it looks like there's plenty of business to go around. Richard Baitlick says the persistency of these new cyber threats means no more one-off jobs.
It's actually been this case now for the whole period of the Chinese activity. The customers want us to stay engaged to the point where we sign multi-year contracts so the customers can get help from Mandiant over a very long period of time.
A cyber war already underway between the Chinese hackers determined to steal and the security folks determined to hunt the hackers down. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
Tom has been reporting all week on cybersecurity, and you can check out his series at our website, npr.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The Industrial Revolution extended the power of human muscle with the invention of machines such as the steam engine. The Computer Revolution is extending the power of the human mind. And one key to that revolution is algorithms. They find search results, pick the top story on your Facebook news feed, determine your credit score. And as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, algorithms are used to predict how ideas travel through society.
My favorite movie is Days of Heaven, and it's at the top of my recommendations on Netflix. But I've never watched it on Netflix, so how did they know that?
So every time a Netflix member streams a title from us, yeah, we learn a little bit more about what's interesting to them.
John Cincuti is the vice president of engineering at Netflix. Their algorithms mix customer information with algorithms the group shows together. So if I enjoy Mad Men, I might like other dramas with complicated male leads.
Their name is Walter White. There are going to be some things that you'll come to learn about me.
Netflix says, I like Breaking Bad, and they got that right. Every day, Netflix has dozens of engineers improving its algorithms. A huge whiteboard in the hallway of Netflix headquarters has numbers on a grid. It's a contest over who can come up with the best algorithms.
Just in the last couple of months, we've run tests where we've improved overall streaming hours for members with a new algorithm that's just a little bit better at making recommendations, which means it's so powerful as far as delighting members that they're more likely to stay with the service versus not.
For Netflix, it's about keeping their customers, but algorithms tailored to figure out individual tastes and interests are now being applied to the political arena.
But I happen to believe that going forward over the coming decade, you're going to see a lot of manufacturing come back to America.
When Mitt Romney is on local TV in Ohio, it's no surprise he's talking about local interests like manufacturing jobs. But it would be even better if he could target the message directly to people who lost their jobs. In this coming election, both the Democrats and the Republicans will be able to do that.
And there's been this explosion of data available over the last decade, frankly, at the individual level, from voter files, from consumer sources, from other sources.
Tom Bonier works with Clarity Labs, a company that uses algorithms to help Democrats take that data and target voters.
You can send one piece of mail about choice to one household, and to their neighbors you can send a piece of mail about the environment.
More computers are hoarding more data about us than ever before.
So from an algorithm's perspective, this is a great time to be alive. You know, algorithms are just frolicking in the mountains of data that they can play with.
This is Sean Gurley, the co-founder and CTO of Quid. His company is hired by governments and businesses to create algorithms. Gurley has developed algorithms to map and predict insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan. His company helps banks map developing markets for new technologies. As an experiment for NPR about Occupy Wall Street, Gurley sorted through 40,000 blogs and articles written since it began and grouped similar ideas together.
You can't read all this as a human or even necessarily get what's going on, so you start to apply algorithms to help kind of cluster, sort, put topics around them, and ultimately visualize.
What Gurley's algorithms help visualize is how ideas that germinated at the initial Occupy Wall Street rallies in New York spread to other groups in parts of the country. Gurley opens up a computer screen filled with dots grouped into color clusters that look like different solar systems with thin lines that connect them. One cluster represents politicians talking about taxing the wealthy. It's far away from the protesters.
When the politicians talk about Occupy Wall Street, they're not really talking in Occupy Wall Street. They're not talking within the cluster. They're talking separately. And so when they talk about taxes and they talk about inequality, it's not really resonating up here, or at least the language is quite different.
Gurley clicks on another smallish cluster. It's bank transfer day. You can see that people aren't talking about that so much anymore. A recent cluster has the issue of the courts using Twitter feeds as evidence in cases against protesters. He clicks another cluster of ideas. This one has to do with Occupy Oakland, which is dominated by talk of police violence.
We can see a conversation with our eyes.
Gurley imagines that information like this might be useful to politicians, police, and political activists.
And we can start to think about where it's come from. We can start to think about how it's evolved. And we can start to think about where we want it to go and if we want to change the direction.
But Gurley has concerns about other possible uses of algorithms. Netflix is just trying to keep its customers watching movies. That's not so bad. But he wonders what would happen if Google Maps knew that you were looking for a new car, and when you were driving to a party, it suggested a route that went right past a dealership.
Has it got your interests at heart, or has it got making money from ads at heart?
What worries Gurley the most is that we humans haven't yet evolved to be as wary of algorithms as we are of used car salesmen. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last May, German investigators arrested someone they suspected of being an Al-Qaeda operative, and they found out that he was carrying several memory chips, and one of them contained a pornographic video. But when the investigators took a closer look, they found that embedded inside that video file were hundreds of secret documents, maps, memos, plans, and the like. It's called steganography, hiding one piece of information inside of another. And it's a common practice, but how do they do that? Well, joining me to talk about it is Peter Wehner. He's author of the book Disappearing Cryptography, Information Hiding, Steganography and Watermarking, now in its third edition. He joins me by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you doing?
How do you do that?
Well, you know, it turns out there are lots of little corners in all the information we see. I mean, we're used to the idea that somehow everything we type in the computer is very exact. If you don't type in the right password, the computer gets upset. If you don't type in the right URL, it gets upset. But it turns out that there's lots of little wiggle room that we don't even realize is there. And that's what steganography uses. We kind of go in and we exploit things. You can make a color just a little bit more blue, or you can make it a little bit more red. And then if you do that enough times, you can send a signal. You can put, and then the computer can piece it all together into a complex message.
So you mean, if you, I remember in the old days of computing, way back before there were mice and things, well, that's how old I am, you used to be able to take a file and read the contents of the file with a text reader. And see all the numbers and symbols and things that made up, let's say, the picture file. Are you saying that you could hide code in those little numbers and things that actually make up the file?
Well, most of the time you can. I mean, it depends. If you're sending something very exact, like your account number for your bank, you're not going to want to make a little mistake there.
Right.
But if you're sending a number like, say, the deficit of the United States around and you're off by a little bit, you can hide a lot of different information in the least significant digits off to the right.
Mm-hmm. How much info can you hide?
Well, it depends how much room there is. I've found, it's kind of a trade-off. The more you stick in there, the more the cover file, you could call it, gets degraded. So, but with an image, you can often take over one quarter of the size of the file for your own purposes, and it doesn't start to look too bad. You don't really notice it.
Now, the bad guys must know that you know this technique that they may be using. So is it really always staying one step ahead or one step behind of your opposition?
Both sides of the communication have to know that the technique is there. And that way, if you're sending a message, the person who's receiving it has to know where to look and how to look for it. What's a little bit fascinating about steganography and what's kind of different from some of the other ways we have of communicating is that there are these kind of greater statistical techniques that you can use that give you kind of an indication that maybe there's something that's hidden there, and you might not be able to figure out what the message is, but you can tell that something's just not right with this file.
And you can do that just out of a gut feeling or experience or cracking the file, or how does that work?
Well, it uses statistics. It's kind of a little bit like the whole Moneyball argument that we hear about baseball. But it goes through the file and it looks and it kind of sees that you could say the noise in the image is not right, and it's often a little too random. It's almost a little bit too perfect, you might say.
Right.
And then the statistics comes out, and it says, oh, well, it gives you a number, and the number is over a threshold, and then you say, oh, well, that's an alarm bell, and I'll look at it.
There must be an interesting history to this whole steganography idea.
Yeah, people certainly have been playing around with this for, you know, thousands of years, and people have been sneaking messages and lots of different things. I mean, personally, I was kind of inspired by an Edgar Allan Poe short story, The Purloined Letter, and that's why I started to think about how you could do it mathematically. But, you know, people have been, you know, taking this approach for a long time.
Yeah, I noticed that you might be able to I think the Romans shipped a parent blank wax tablets, and then you scrape off the wax, something's in there?
Oh, sure. There are lots of different ways you could do this. And in fact, I mean, the story that's floating around, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, I haven't been able to dig deep enough to find out, is that during World War II, the censors would go through and they would kind of change numerical tables. So if somebody was sending a letter to someone in the theater and saying, you know, Johnny got good grades, got an A, B, a C, or something like that, they might change them around a little bit. Mm-hmm. Or they might change, you know, put little changes just in case someone was trying to sneak a message in you know, some table of data.
So what's the difference between steganography? And I'm interested in the origin of the word steganography. Can you take that apart for us?
Well,
sounds like almost like a dinosaur.
Yeah, certainly. It goes back to the Greeks, and it right. basically means hidden writing.
Right.
And so and what it often gets kind of mixed together with or lumped together with is encryption, and it's kind of they're like close cousins, and they're trying to do the same thing, but they have slightly different approaches.
And that was my next question. What is the difference between steganography and encryption?
Well, there's a lot of overlap, and the scientists like to kind of parse things and make distinctions. The way I like to explain it is, I said, you know, encryption is building the safe, and steganography is trying to find a painting to hide the safe behind.
Interesting. And there must be not sneaky reasons why you would use steganography.
Yeah, there are plenty of reasons. I mean, obviously, anytime you want to communicate with someone in a secret way, you know, may or may not be legitimate. But there are also turning out to be, you know, other ways that scientists are using it and engineers are using it. It's a good way for combating counterfeit. And there are these kind of numerical ways that you can go and you can hide, check digits, or you can hide ways. Signatures inside of files, and they operate the same way that the government puts all their little secret signals in cash, or the way that the people try to thwart counterfeiters that way.
Yeah, it's like watermarks.
Yeah, watermarks, exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously the content industry is very interested in watermarking because they have that hope that this might be able to allow them to kind of combat piracy. And what I've also found is that when you deal with programming, it turns out steganography is very useful because it allows you to kind of add an additional layer of features or data without breaking the old software that was out there. So the old software just deals with the data as if the steganographic message wasn't there, but the new software can come along and it can look in the corners and it can find it, and they can work side by side.
It'd be fun to experiment and fool around with steganography. Is there an app for that that you can sort of make your own? See how it works?
Well, I mean, I just put together a book. I wrote Disappearing Cryptography a while ago, but I put together an iPad version of it, and it's, you know, just started. It just reached the iPad store the last week or so. It's called How to Hide Online, and it's a simpler version. I mean, it has some basic text, and then all the illustrations are interactive. You can hide a message with the interactive gadgets that are in the book.
Mm-hmm. And if I were to upload, let's say I make a picture, I hide something in it, and I were to embed something in a movie or on a memory stick, and I want to upload it to Flickr or Facebook or something like that, would it screw up the steganography that's going on there? Would the encryption that they do to upload it, would that, and if I want to send it to somebody, would it,
you know, it depends.
Mess it up?
I just sent a file this morning, and it got munged, and it got messed up in some strange way. But then I sent it a different way, and it went through fine. The internet's a little bit spooky that way. One thing that does happen with sites like Flickr or with YouTube is that they try to use very advanced compression algorithms to make the files as small as possible. And the advanced compression can be your enemy if you're trying to send a secret message with steganography.
What was it? What was it about this captured Al-Qaeda pornography video that got people's attention and that they thought there might be something in it?
Well, I don't think that they have as much intelligence from Al-Qaeda as they would like. And so I think the stories I read, a lot of them concentrated on just what was in these documents. And so I think that was the documents themselves were the most exciting. I think there's something a little bit ironic in the fact that they chose to hide them in a pornographic movie. So that will always get you headlines. And I think it's new. Despite the fact that people have been talking about steganography for a long time, there aren't many real cases that you see come along, as they say, steganography in the wild.
Is there something, place you can study it? Is it a topic you can take in college, or you have to go to special school or military to study this?
Well, there are several books out there. If you want to take it in college, there are some general courses on encryption, and they often get kind of lumped in there, and they'll spend a week or two on steganography. There are, you can poke around. The article on Wikipedia is quite nice, and so, somewhere along all those different choices, you can get a pretty good education.
I have a tweet that came in from Rob I, who says, "You experience steganography every day if you watch digital cable TV. Is that right?"
Well, there are lots of different things that the television companies do. It doesn't necessarily have to be digital cable TV. There was a while that there was a gap. Every time your television went to a new line, there would be this momentary pause in the broadcast and to allow the electron gun to get back to the left-hand side of your screen again.
Yes.
And for a while, the TV companies were broadcasting extra information in there that they were making some money on, because spectrum is so expensive. And it's definitely true that with digital cable TV, the TV companies are doing their best to pack information as best as possible, and they try to have different levels of resolution. And it's kind of an economic game to see how they can pack it all together and see how good the resolution needs to be to keep people happy.
Yeah. Well, Peter Wader, thank you for taking time to talk about steganography with us.
Sure.
He's author of the book Disappearing Cryptography, Information Hiding Steganography, and Watermarking, now in its third edition. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how America got supersized and what we can do about it, a new HBO series starting. We'll talk with the producer, and he'll be here to talk about The Weight of the Nation, airing next week. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
U.S. patent number D486486 reads, quote, "A display device with a movable assembly attached to a flat panel display and to a base," end quote. Then there's patent number D469109 for, quote, "the ornamental design for a media player, substantially as shown and described." Those are just a couple of the hundreds of patents that bear the name Stephen P. Jobs, the late CEO of Apple. A new exhibition opened on Friday at the Smithsonian's Ripley Center here in Washington, D.C., and it's titled The Patents and Trademarks of Steve Jobs, Art and Technology That Changed the World. Walter Isaacson is the author of Steve Jobs' biography. He joins us now in our studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me, Rachel.
So when we think of the pantheon of great American inventors, Edison and Ford, the Wright brothers come to mind. Based on the work that you did and your relationship with Steve Jobs, does he belong in that company?
Oh, absolutely. And he had the greatest design collaboration of our day and era, which is he and Johnny Ive, who is the great industrial designer at Apple. And you mentioned the display device with movable arms or whatever. That's the famous sort of sunflower-looking iMac that they did, I think, in the early 2000s. And it came about when a flat screen was developed, and Johnny had created something in which the screen was attached to the computer, and it didn't feel like it had real integrity. Then Jobs was kind of annoyed, and he went home, and His wife, who plants this beautiful garden behind the house in Palo Alto, had planted sunflowers, a profusion of them. And when Johnny came over, they were sitting there and walking around, and they just looked at the sunflowers and how there's a certain essence of the sunflower and how it floats above the plant. And that became that iMac. And, of course, Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive have their names on the design patent.
Is the credit that Steve Jobs is given for these patents deserved insofar as his ability to kind of identify something like that sunflower? Yeah. I mean, is that as valuable as being able to put it into making something out of it?
Well, one of the things Steve was able to do is conceive great designs, but also execute them. He had an intuitive feel for things. Like at one point, Johnny Ive showed him a recessed handle that was on that beautiful iMac of, I think, the late 1990s. It felt like it had just hopped on your desk. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the rabbit-looking iMac. It had a handle, and the handle wasn't truly necessary. This was a desktop machine, but Johnny Ive explained it makes it friendly. People are afraid to touch computers, but having a recessed handle makes it just say to you, you can touch me, I'm at your service. And that's what Steve Jobs understood.
And it was every step of product development, packaging even.
You know, he was taught in the early 1980s by a great guy named Mike Markala that the packaging really matters. You have to impute a beauty to a product from the moment people see the box. And so he has a design patent with some other people at Apple. I think Steve's name may be first on it, of just the way you open the box to the original iPod and how it is cradled. And you open it and it hinges like a jewel. There's a certain theater, an emotional theater in the unpacking.
Makes me feel like I should wrap my Christmas presents better.
You should.
If you had to pick one, what was one of the fiercest fights that Steve Jobs and Apple had to fight when it came to patents?
Well, obviously the fiercest fight was the fight against Microsoft in the 1980s. And there's a good example of a design look and feel originally developed at Xerox PARC, which is a graphical user interface. And you're looking at a computer screen now, and it probably has icons like trash cans and folders and documents
Indeed
and everything else.
Indeed it does.
Some of those elements were invented at Xerox PARC. Steve made a deal with Xerox that the Apple team could come in, see it, and try to adopt it. And what Steve did was he improved it. You could drag the documents and dump them into folders. You could double-click on the folders, and they would pop open. You could pull down menus. All of these were improvements to the design Apple did. So then Microsoft comes along and pretty much copies a lot of the look and feel of that graphical user interface for Windows. And that was one of the great intellectual property fights of our time, because Steve Jobs felt pretty strongly that Microsoft had ripped off the look and feel of the Macintosh operating system.
Hmm. You had extraordinary access to him. Did you come away thinking that it was more important for him to be remembered as an artist rather than an incredibly successful revolutionary CEO?
Absolutely. Look, when they do the original Macintosh in 1983, he holds it up for a while because the circuit board isn't beautiful enough for his taste. Now, that's not the way to maximize profits, but it is the way to say, I'm an artist, and even the parts unseen should be beautiful.
Walter Isaacson is the author of Steve Jobs' biography. The patents and trademarks of Steve Jobs' exhibition is on display at the Smithsonian's Ripley Center here in Washington, D.C. until July 8th. Walter Isaacson, thanks so much for coming in.
It was great being with you, Rachel.
You are listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. High gas prices earlier this year meant more people started looking for alternative ways to get around, and mass transit ridership in the country got one of the biggest boosts in decades. That means subways and buses, and to a lesser degree, trains, which are really popular on the East Coast, not nearly as efficient or ubiquitous in other parts of the country. 3 years ago, President Obama laid out a plan to try to change that.
Imagine whisking through towns at speeds over 100 miles an hour, walking only a few steps to public transportation, and ending up just blocks from your destination. Imagine what a great project that would be to rebuild America.
Today, there are a few Amtrak trains going that fast, but as NPR's David Shaper reports, for the most part, the president's plans for high-speed trains have slowed considerably.
I'm riding on Amtrak's Wolverine service, which goes from Chicago to Ann Arbor, then Detroit and Pontiac. We're somewhere in southwest Michigan, speeding along at over 100 miles an hour, and this train is about to hit a speed milestone.
Now cruising at 110 miles per hour in the Amtrak Michigan District. We're being pulled today by two General Electric locomotives.
That's Amtrak spokesman Mark Maglieri announcing the fastest speed of any U.S. train outside of Amtrak's Northeast Corridor. It's quite a feat, even though the trains are only able to go that fast over about a 90-mile portion of the trip.
But it's got to be viewed as only a beginning.
Joe Szabo is administrator of the Federal Railroad Administration. He says additional track and signal improvements are underway to help speed up trains throughout the Midwest.
And so in the next two and a half years, you're going to see almost 80% of Chicago-Detroit and almost 80% of Chicago-St. Louis at sustained speeds of 110 miles per hour.
That would reduce travel times on those routes to under 4 hours, making the train faster than driving and competitive with flying, says Szabo. Both the Michigan and Illinois routes are benefiting from other states turning down high-speed rail funds. The Republican governors in Wisconsin, Ohio, and Florida sent back hundreds of millions of dollars in stimulus funding, arguing that few people would ride the trains, so their states would have been on the hook for millions in operating subsidies. So that makes Michigan's Republican Governor Rick Snyder an outlier of sorts, because he sees spending on high-speed rail as a wise investment. Here's Michigan Transportation Director Kirk Steidel.
Our folks in Michigan are looking for it. They're interested. They want to ride it. As I said, the ridership numbers are going up, and it proves that, passenger transportation is a very viable option in Michigan for the corridor between Detroit and Chicago.
Amtrak says it had a record number of riders nationwide last year, and with gas prices still relatively high, the rail service is on track for another record year. But it's hardly smooth sailing for fast trains in this country.
Increasing top speeds to 110 miles an hour does not necessarily make a high-speed rail service.
Ken Orski is a former top U.S. Department of Transportation official and now publishes a transportation newsletter. And he says what really counts is the average speed over an entire trip. And that's where Amtrak has trouble. Since most Amtrak trains run on freight railroad tracks, freight train backups often cause lengthy Amtrak delays. And the poor condition of some stretches of the leased track can slow passenger trains to just 20 to 25 miles an hour until repairs can be made. Orski says high-speed rail works best in densely populated corridors between cities only a few hundred miles apart, such as the Northeast Corridor between Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C.
And that is where the administration should have focused its efforts, rather than scatter $10 billion on some 140 projects in 32 states.
That $10 billion mostly came from the stimulus package 3 years ago, and a big chunk of it went to California, which is developing 200-mile-an-hour high-speed rail service between Los Angeles and San Francisco. It's a project many experts say shows some promise. But its ballooning cost and planning problems lead some critics to call it the train to nowhere. Congress has, for now, put the brakes on funding for high-speed rail. But high-speed rail advocates say if Amtrak can at least get enough funding to keep making improvements, that may whet the appetite for greater rail spending in the future. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Every week, as part of the new tech segment, we'll dig into our digital sandbox for some fun. It may be a game, advice about how to behave in the internet age, or today's review of a popular app called Draw Something. It's like Pictionary. Players pick a word, draw clues, and then watch as their opponents guess the answer. We asked someone with artistic prowess to give it a try.
Yeah, the first thing I was supposed to draw was a peanut.
That's New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie.
And it looked like someone had stepped in melted cheese.
As we'll hear in Diffie's review, the app's name is a little bit misleading.
Okay, so first of all, I think the name Draw Something isn't entirely accurate. It'd be more accurate to call it Scrawl Something, because that's what I did. Or maybe draw something with your foot while bull riding on a boat. I mean, you know, I don't know if I have big fingers or not, but I'm playing it on a phone rather than an iPad, so it's just like, it's like getting to drive a Ferrari on a racquetball court. It's just frustrating. You're like, oh, come on. And it's not very responsive. You know, I know how to draw well, And so in my mind, I'm making all these intricate little finger moves, and I'm drawing, in my mind, I'm drawing like a Rembrandt, but what's on the screen looks more like the work of Jimmy the Painting Chimp. To sum it all up, I sat down there for like, I thought 20 minutes, and suddenly I've been on there an hour. So to that level, it was very successful in like passing the time and being entertained. And as soon as I let go of the idea of it being like a drawing tool and embraced it as being a game, then it was wonderful. I'm one of those guys, even in cartooning, I tend to draw things better than they need to be. And it's really fun to just sort of relax and just draw something badly.
That's New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie, and if you'd like to see some of his sketches, perhaps his Draw Something rendition of John Travolta, or give a review of your own favorite drawing app, visit our website at npr.org. Next week, we'll introduce another new piece of our all-tech segment, a social media advice column, so please email your tech comments and questions to alltech@npr.org.